nightmare. Barbara Stanwyck, chained to a deep, dangerous secret. Edward G. Robinson, under compulsion to kill. Betty Field, wanting yet fearing love. Robert Cummings, taking beauty where he found it. Robert Benchley, who tried not to be afraid. Thomas Mitchell, who peered into the awesome future. Charles Wininger, Anna Lee, C. Aubrey Smith, Dame Mae Whitty, Edgar Barrier, in a drama of love, of hate, of terror, of volcanic emotions that changed 8 lives.
I had a dream too on the boat, all night while I was asleep. Maybe it will come true.
If you want it to, it will.
I've never wanted anything more in my life.
There are things. It's sometimes better not to know.
Speak out, man. What is in my hand?
Murder.
Stars out tonight, King.
Perhaps they're telling us something. I think we should listen.
Neighbor, how long has it been since you had yourself a big hot screaming ear full of forgotten horrors? Well, that's too long. Pull in close now for a crepuscular half hour or so of the Forgotten Horrors Podcast with your hosts, John Woolley, Michael H. Price, and my own self, Wolf Brand Jack.
And thank you very much, Michael H. Price. I'm John Woolley, and we're very glad to have you aboard for another Forgotten Horrors podcast. Michael,
we're going to talk
about a couple of movies tonight, but they both have a lot in common. And
they're almost conjoined, although
there are some very big differences between a Hollywood, you call them portmanteau films, I think, or a briefcase movie. Yeah, anthology pictures. And one is Flesh and Fantasy from 1943, Universal Picture. And the other is a British picture from 1945, a very famous anthology picture, a horror anthology called Dead of Night. Let's start with the 1943 film. And the first thing I think, people who are used to the Universal horror films, which incidentally were the films that kept the studio alive in the 30s.
Right.
Were B pictures, essentially. This is not, is it? This is an A picture.
Well, it's got a top of the line cast. It's got a top of the line director, Julien Duvivier.
Mm-hmm.
And Edward G. Robinson, Charles Boyer, Barbara Stanwyck. What a lineup.
Yeah, Bob Cummings, Charles Boyer produced it, right?
And Robert Benchley, the great humorist, who was a heck of a movie personality as well.
And was doing those shorts at that time, which are absolutely hilarious. They've kind of been forgotten now. But things like Sex Life of the Polyp, they're wonderful. Those are wonderful shorts. And, of course, at that time, was it Road to Utopia he was in, Michael?
I believe that's right.
You know, where he does the narration and for Paramount. It's just wonderful. But
The Reluctant Dragon for Disney.
Right, right.
An amazing presence on the screen. And what is this picture about? Well, it's about so much varied stuff that they had to chop off one story and make a separate movie out of it.
Which is kind of the reason, as I understand it, they brought in Benchley. to kind of provide the continuity, because the film starts with a body being washed up on shore, and in the original film, that was the body of a killer, who had taken refuge in a farmer's barn, and the farmer's blind daughter was helping him, and there was all this stuff going on, and they just cut that out completely, and it ended up being another picture, right?
Yeah. The following year, it was filmed, expanded into a feature film called Destiny,
mm-hmm.
with Alan Curtis and dear little Gloria Jean.
A great B picture cast, wasn't it?
Oh yeah. Gloria Jean was one of W.C. Field's favorite comic foils.
Oh yeah, she did a great job in Poppy, right?
Oh yeah, she did. Mm-hmm. And of course, Never Give a Sucker an Even Break.
Mm-hmm.
And just an all around wonderful set of consequences came out of this one film being too much for one running time to handle.
And Destiny's almost a film noir, isn't it?
Very much, mm-hmm. much. And right mm-hmm. in that period for prime noir.
Mm-hmm. 1946, or not 44, I'm sorry, yeah.
44, Destiny. Mm-hmm. Destiny dates from that. And then that leads us right into 1945 and English studio that did Dead of Night.
So let's go back then for a moment to Flesh and Fantasy. And I'm very proud of my research that I did on the guy with Robert Benchley in mm-hmm. the what is basically a club.
Right.
You know, they're sitting there talking. And Robert Benchley's talking about, well, he's having dreams of fortune tellers ganging up on him. And it's just a typical Benchley kind of thing. And the guy with him is a very unusual looking actor named David Hoffman. Mm-hmm. And David Hoffman was the guy who was the narrator, the spirit, at the beginning of the Inner Sanctum movies for Universal, right? In that kind of jar where his face is all twisted up and everything, and he's doing the narration.
That's wonderful.
The same guy.
Well, you know, and all the more reason to make this Flesh and Fantasy an essential film for the a built-in audience for the Universal Spookers.
Which, of course, it was not. It seemed to me that it had higher aspirations. Am I right on that?
Definitely. But then a lot of not in the 40s period, but in the 30s, the Universal horror pictures did have categorically higher aspirations.
Well,
this
true.
Is kind of a throwback to those. There's a distinct supernatural angle.
Mm-hmm.
David Hoffman is the perfect face for that sequence. Because,
boy, is he ever.
Ooh-wee, and he's got that wonderful set of luminous eyes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Where you almost George Zucco eyes.
Or
almost
or Fritz Lieber eyes.
Or Betty right? Davis.
Or Betty Davis eyes. There you go, yeah. From the Kim Carnes song of the same name, yeah.
Exactly. And the framing sequence sets the mood ideally in the sense that it creates an ominous mood mm-hmm. at the same time a very humorous mood.
Right, right. And that's kind of what prevails throughout the picture in some ways, at least until, well, that's not true, because you really get the Edward G. Robinson, the Charles Boyer segments, the three stories that they do, or the two stories that they do are not humorous at all.
By no means.
Yeah. And,
but there's a connection there. It's like, I can't believe I'm watching this. I can't believe this is happening. There's that, it's the same vibe you get off Robinson in Night Has a Thousand Eyes.
Right. Good point. Good point. Or as Robinson says in Key Largo, never get between me and my liquor. It's got that sort of vibe that with Edward G. Robinson, because he's just sort of over the top here in the second. Now, the first one, I should say, has Bob Cummings in it. And at that time, Bob Cummings is a pretty big star. And I believe is it Betty Field that's in that one? I believe it's Betty Field who is the
Betty
female
Field.
Lead. Yeah.
She is the bitter, disappointed woman.
And there's a lot of kind of overheated romantic dialogue in this, but it still works pretty well because it works. And again, the body, it starts with a body washing up on shore, which would have been the body from the first segment had it not been excised and blown up into a feature film, as we talked about, called Destiny.
Yes.
The second picture is, you know, one of the things that they tout is that there's an Oscar Wilde story in this. Mm-hmm. That's the second segment of this picture with Edward G. Robinson. And boy, Thomas Mitchell is so good, isn't he, in this?
Isn't he, though? He's anytime Thomas Mitchell arrives on screen, you know you're in for some heavy duty character.
Yeah, yeah.
And he could not stop portraying.
No. And he plays a palm reader, and basically Edward G. Robinson's character crosses his path. This is in London, and Edward G. Robinson gets obsessed with murdering someone. And anyone, not anybody in particular, just someone. And it's, I think this is probably the best of the three stories, don't you think?
I think it's the one that I think of first when I recall the experience.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's not, although, you know, Charles Boyer and Barbara Stanwyck, there's a lot of star power in that one, which is the third segment, where he plays the great Gaspar, the drunken tightrope walker that keeps seeing a woman, and it turns out to be Barbara Stanwyck. It's a kind of a little bit of a convoluted story, isn't it, that third one?
Yeah, it's like okay, the trapeze artist falls for a dame.
Right.
And wait a minute, do you mean falls? and of course, Boyer he seems almost an unknowable presence in many, yes, of his portrayals.
That's a very good point. A very
aloof, a distant, not the kind of guy you'd think you could accept as a pal, and yet he's got this mystique and this tormented air. Speaking of universal almost horror films, have you ever seen A Woman's Vengeance?
No.
That's Boyer at his most aloof and yet affecting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he's quite like that as the trapeze artist or the high wire walker in the circus setting. And of course, you know, who isn't a sucker for a circus horror movie?
Boy, especially with a drunken tightrope walker.
Yeah,
I mean, boy, that's all the elements are pretty much there, aren't they? Absolutely. Kind of get circus of horrors going there.
Oh yeah, I think of I keep a working collection of circus movies, and doggone if most of them aren't really creepy.
Oh yeah, it's kind of like clowns, isn't it?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Same thing.
There's something about the circus, and especially about the sideshow,
mm-hmm,
but certainly about the overall the hippodrome, the whole circus scene. It really does lend itself to that kind of tormented personality.
It does. It absolutely does. And you know, Boyer in this as the tightrope walker, he didn't just play the tightrope walker. He also produced the picture, and it's the only picture he produced. And I've got to believe that he and Julien Duvivier, who was also French, and they had worked together the year before on that, what, Tales of Manhattan, which was another anthology picture.
Right on.
And I just wonder if maybe out of that they thought, well, this anthology picture works. Let's do an anthology about, you know, scary stuff.
Right.
Or offbeat or occult or whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's what happened. But, you know, this is the only feature film Boyer ever produced.
Well, it's a good come and go experience.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it absolutely is. And do you think that Dead of Night was influenced in any way by this?
Oh, there's no doubt about it. The thing had international distribution. Ealing was in many ways the British Universal Pictures.
Really? I never thought about it that way.
Oh yeah, they and you can't mistake an Ealing for a Universal, but they have that same air of class.
Know this part of the world at all?
No. I've never been here before.
You'd like some tea, wouldn't you? Do you take milk and sugar? Milk and sugar, Mr. Craig. Milk and sugar, Mr. Craig.
Still there. So it isn't a dream this time.
I beg your pardon?
Yes, it isn't a dream this time. I must be going out of my mind. You see, everybody in this room is part of my dream. Everybody.
Gosh. Good Lord, really?
Very extraordinary.
You're kidding.
What, all of us?
I can only tell you that when I came into this room, I recognized you all instantly.
Having seen all our photographs in the newspapers, I take it, Dr. Van Swarten.
Of course, you may have seen me on the sports page. Motor racing's my life. That was my chance. I can't make it. I can't make it.
Just room for one inside, sir.
Sort of teamed up with him, aren't you?
Him? My good man, think nothing of it. I'm just about through with that cheap ham anyway. Temper. You'll be sorry for this later, you know.
Yes, I suppose I will.
Let's play another game.
Yes, hide and seek.
Who's to hide?
I'll hide.
Yes, it's great.
Well, you know, Dead of Night came along after the much talked about British horror band. You know, all of us monster kids and all the people who study horror films know that the Brits banned horror films late 30s and through the 40s. And really, this should have gotten what the British called an H certificate, which was... you had to be over 16 to see the picture. I'm talking about Dead of Night now. Yeah. But it got an A, which if you were a child accompanied by an adult, you could get in. So it's basically the difference between X and R, I suppose.
Well, or a PG and an R. Yeah, sure.
A PG and an R, yeah. And so Dead of Night has been, and I think after seeing it again, I hadn't seen it since for years until Joey and I watched it here a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. It's been touted as one of the great horror films or ghost films or whatever you supernatural film. And I really believe it deserves that.
One of the best. I think, a stronger narrative link among the different stories
mm-hmm.
than there is in the Universal picture of a couple of years earlier.
Mm-hmm.
The main glue that holds it together is good old dependable Mervyn Johns,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
who plays the architect who goes to accept a new assignment at a country estate.
Mr. Craig,
and he's mm-hmm. never been there before, but he knows this. He recognizes everybody who is gathered there. I know you people. You've been in my... Okay, well... this is obviously the trigger for some of the guests to tell their awkward, weird stories. but it's also the trigger that will drive Walter Craig to madness by the end
mm-hmm.
of the film.
Mm-hmm.
He keeps going back to him, and he goes like, "Well, wow, that was quite a story." Anybody else got some more?
Right. And the stories get longer and longer, don't they? I mean, they start out short and they get longer and longer.
And then they get more and more tormented.
Right.
And finally, apparently the anecdotal stories, are they imaginary? Did they really happen? we never know, but somehow they all merge.
They do.
Into one experience for this kind of, you know, mild-mannered architect who doesn't look like a man of action, but he at length breaks into a violent outburst that climaxes the film, except it comes full circle.
It does. It does. And, you know, a lot of people never talk about, we're so really kind of, I guess, inured to the films like Amicus did in the 70s, where there's just there's like a narrative, or even like really Dead of Night, where there's just kind of a little narrative thing to hold them together. But really the narrative in Dead of Night is a sixth story. I mean, the ending of that story is as terrifying as anything you would want to see. And, you know, without giving it away, it itself is as big and as involving, I guess, as the stories that are told under the umbrella of this anthology, people telling different ghost stories. In a home in England where they're all drinking tea or alcohol and entertaining one another. It's a fascinating piece of work. I think everybody talks mostly about the Michael Redgrave part, which is toward the end, which is the last big story.
And it's got that wonderful element of the creepy dummy.
Oh man! Oh man! Yeah.
Which of course would prove influential on many another story, although it too has a precedence in a story that Ben Hecht wrote, the great journalist and playwright.
One of my favorite writers.
Ooh wee! Well, have you ever read Hecht's The Rival Dummy?
You bet I have.
Oh yeah, and of course that was the basis for the earliest creepy dummy movie I can recall, The Great Gobbo,
which was Eric von Stroheim, right?
Right. Yeah, his mm-hmm. first talking picture.
That's right. That's right. And now is The Great Gobbo? I'm getting it mixed up with the one with Peggy Ann Garner in it.
Oh, the Great Gobbo is the one that takes place basically in the back alleys of low rent vaudeville.
Right.
Until Gobbo
graduates
to Broadway.
Right.
With this totally unreal dummy act. It's mm-hmm. like, how did he do that? Well. Chris Stroheim himself didn't do the dummy act, but it was based on an actual vaudeville to Broadway headliner act,
right?
In which the ventriloquist would make the dummy talk while dining and smoking. Amazing stuff there.
You know, I said Peggy Ann Garner. I mean Mary Beth Hughes.
Oh, you're thinking of the Great Flammarion.
That's I am. I am.
Yes,
thank you,
are.
Great Flammarion. Yeah, yeah. So one of the things about Dead of Night, when it got an American release, they cut out one of the middle stories, which was the one about the golfers, which is really, the more I think about that picture, the more I think about that segment, the more I think that it's really kind of risque, isn't it?
And a very cruel story.
Cruel indeed, under the mask of, or under the sort of the umbrella of whimsicality, it seems like, mm-hmm. because it's of all of them, it's the one where you're kind of supposed to chuckle at these two knuckleheads that are vying for the love of the same girl.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, the fact that the two rivals are played by one of the great comedy teams, not necessarily in comedy films, but one of the great comedy teams in otherwise dangerous and suspenseful films. That's Basil Radford and Norton Wayne.
I did not know they were a team.
They were. They teamed for Alfred Hitchcock, for example. They made a number of pictures together, and it was very much a kind of a, Ronnie Barker,
mm-hmm.
English actor,
mm-hmm.
Told me that Radford and Wayne were the inspirations that drove Ronnie Corbett and Ronnie Barker to create the two Ronnies for BBC.
Right, right.
And of course, these guys are very funny, but the story, their story, which I've read many explanations or attempted explanations of why the picture was cut out in the American release.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was simply because it was just altogether too British. And the distributor, yeah. The American distributor, they won't get that. Well, it's about an obsession to golf.
Mm-hmm.
Golf, shared obsession with golf, shared obsession with a lovely young woman.
Mm-hmm.
And yet these are inseparable friends. They make a wager on a match that the loser commits suicide.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is an H.G. Wells story, too.
That's an H.G. Wells story, mm-hmm. written around the time, that later period when he wrote basically the genetic template for what would later become Nigel Neale's Quatermass stories, mm-hmm. for BBC.
Mm-hmm.
That H.G. Wells story of that period that I'm thinking of is called The Croquet Player.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Involves the intrusion, here we go again, another ghost.
Right,
as
right.
In the golfing story in Dead of Night. And, do ghosts return? I don't know, do they? Well, if they do, what do they want?
Right, right.
Well, it's pretty
right.
evident what the suicide victim in Dead of Night wants. He wants, he basically wants to cheat and reconfigure the rivalry so that he gets the girl.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't want to give that away, but there's an interesting, and it does have a different tone, I think, than the rest of the picture. Do you not agree?
It feels unlike the rest of the picture, but then none of the individual stories feels like any of the other
right.
individuals.
That's true. That's a good point.
They all are the voice and told in the voice of the person doing the telling.
Well, it's a far more compelling picture, I think, than Flesh and Fantasy. But Flesh and Fantasy is a very interesting film. I think both of these pictures we can recommend, can't we?
Definitely. I wouldn't have it any other way.
No.
I will go back and watch. Get yourself an ideal triple bill. Yeah, Flesh and Fantasy, Destiny, and Dead of Night.
Yeah, and end with Dead of Night.
Yeah, three consecutive years, three of the finest example of the anthology film I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Anyone who remembers fondly the Amicus anthology pictures of the
yes. Yes.
1960s is really going to dig these two and, I guess, two and a third. I don't know.
Two and a third, two and a half, yeah, somewhere in there. Yeah.
Like a great trio.
Yeah, they absolutely do. Michael, what have you got out these days? I know that your album, your Western Swing album, is with Michael H. Price and the Western Swing Masters, has been number one on the Amazon list for weeks and weeks now in the Western Swing category. Congratulations.
I don't know how that happened, but I won't reject it.
Well, I'm sure that it was the full force of my program behind it was what propelled you to number one. But no,
well,
for those who don't know, I have a Western Swing radio program on public radio, tulsa.org. You can pick it up at 7 p.m. Tulsa time every Saturday night. And Michael was nice enough, you were nice enough to name your first Western Swing album, Michael H. Price and the Western Swing Masters, after my show Swing On This, and yep. Propelled it right to the top. So there you go. Since then,
well,
you've done
a lot of mutual back scratching going
well,
on.
Well, there it is, you know, and why not?
Exactly.
But you've got like three or four of them out now?
The sequels are, they keep on coming. We just released the Christmas collection.
Yes.
Called Santa Claus Blues. It's like, okay, we're basically, I'm cherry picking a catalog that goes back to the 1990s.
Right, right.
Adding the occasional brand new recording, but a lot of this material originally never got released as Western Swing.
Mm-hmm.
when you think about what it takes to, as Doug saw, you just can't live in Texas if you don't have a lot of soul. and the whole Western swing scene and Texas blues scene together form a whole greater than the sum of the parts.
Right, right.
You listen to Bob Wills, you're listening to the blues.
Mm-hmm.
For example, a Texas rocker like Ray Sharp, and you're hearing not only a heavy-duty investment in the blues, but you're hearing a childhood grown up since the 1940s and 50s, whose first musical influences were Western swing and mm-hmm. country music in general.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So and Tulsa, Tulsa and Texas have a lot in common there, don't they?
Definitely, yeah. Mm-hmm. If it hadn't been for Tulsa, Bob Wills probably would not have made his big successful leap into the big time.
Thank you. Thank you, KVOO, and 25,000 watts later expanded to 50,000 watts of clear channel flamethrower. Yeah.
Texas was not very good to Bob Wills at first, mm-hmm. at least mm-hmm. his main employer was not. And when he said, I'm getting out of here, he landed in Tulsa and suddenly found himself taken off like he never could have done in Texas.
Exactly right. Exactly right. So if you like Western swing, and you know, one of the things Joey and I have been talking about, our producer, Joey Hambrick, and Joey is also my social media guy. And it's like, and I'm sure it's the same thing with you. You do a lot of different things. You write about horror movies. You write about Western swing. You perform Western swing. You do all of these things, and we just only hope that people who like, as a friend of mine, you say at the Tulsa World, if you like that sort of thing, that's the sort of thing you'll like. And I would highly recommend your albums. I'm playing them on my show, Swing On This. And I would highly recommend our books, too. And that segues into Rudy Ray Moore.
Oh, yeah.
And Eddie Murphy's new film at this recording. Thank you, Joey. Yeah, the film has just come out. Dolomite is my name, mm-hmm. and I have to say that you were involved in Rudy Ray Moore's career to a certain extent. Could you talk about that?
The latter stages of Rudy's career, this would be in the mid to late 1980s when he was basically a forgotten figure, except by certain artists such as Eddie Murphy, mm-hmm. who owed great debts of inspiration. But nobody was talking about Rudy Ray Moore, who was known for his portrayal of a hard-charging, foul-mouthed man of action named Dolomite. And a friend of ours, mutual friend of ours in Arlington, Texas, Tom Renoni, mm-hmm. and I were talking one day about, well, whatever happened to Rudy Ray Moore? He was right up there with Lenny Bruce in terms of testing the First Amendment via raunchy comedy.
Sure.
And you know, you bought his records under the counter. They were called party records. A comedian once told me, well, you know what party records are? And I said, well, I think I do. What are party records? And he says, those are the records you put on to play after the church folks have gone home. And Tom and I said, you know, let's find out whatever happened to him. Because we didn't have quite the internet resources then in 1987 that we do now today.
Right.
But we did some calls and with my newspaper connections and Tom's art world connections and music industry connections, we tracked him down. He answered his own phone, didn't have a secretary.
Just wow.
Said, I'm retired. And I said, well, how about unreturn? He said, well, I do a little comedy now. I said, now and then I've got my G-rated comedy routine that I do for my mama's church folks. I said, well, where is that? He said, in Dallas. I said, you're coming. You're going to be in Dallas? He was living in Los Angeles.
And mm-hmm.
I said, well, how about when you're in Texas, we get you some blues club, comedy club bookings? He said, you could do that? And I said, well, one way to find out. We booked him at one kind of a college kid's hangout in Fort Worth, and a in a more traditional blues club in Dallas for a weekend. And the next thing you know, he's rediscovered his Dolomite self. And it was quite astonishing and rewarding to see this fellow who had basically considered himself washed up.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't. But he, when he got over that self-perception, he made a wonderful comeback, appeared on the Arsenio Hall show. Mm-hmm. Around 1990, recorded an album with Big Daddy Kane, where he won the battle of the rhyming insults. And I don't think Kane let him win either. Rudy told me that he had been approached by Eddie Murphy during the 1980s. To see if he might appear in a Murphy film, which never happened.
Right.
The picture was called Coming to America, and I know why it didn't happen, because Eddie Murphy ended up playing a variety of different parts in extravagant makeups, and obviously one of those would have been the Rudy Ray Moore character.
Sure.
All these years later, and Rudy's no longer with us, but all this time later, Eddie Murphy says, I'm going to do that man proud.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen the entire picture, but from what I have seen, it looks like a labor of love.
It is. And, you know, Joey and I were talking about this earlier, Michael, and it's like it's the African-American Ed Wood movie.
Yep.
And in fact, we were even talking about there may be an analog between Martin Landau's portrayal of Bela Lugosi and the portrayal of D'Urville Martin.
D'Urville Martin, yeah.
By Wesley Snipes.
Right.
And it's just, it's a pretty, I mean, there's some analogs there because it's a celebration of somebody who is underground. And I think Rudy Ray Moore probably was more successful, he was more successful as a filmmaker than Ed Wood. But it's fascinating, and his career is fascinating, and his films are fascinating. And you know, in Forgotten Horrors to the Nth Degree, we talk about Petey Wheatstraw, the devil's brother-in-law. And I think instead of maybe doing that picture the next time, or talking about that picture the next time we do the podcast, maybe you should talk about something a little bit more obscure. And I would like to propose to you, and I haven't really talked to you about this, but what do you think about doing Disco Godfather?
Rudy had high hopes for Disco Godfather. He was disappointed. He had not wanted to make Disco Godfather. His proposal for that picture that became Disco Godfather was to make a film called The Legend of Stagger Lee. Original Dolomite, mm-hmm. The original bad black man.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. The great heroic figure. It was like John Henry in reverse.
Right. Right.
Stagger Lee. A bad man of such force and power that he winds up getting hanged and sent down to hell and wrestled Satan for the throne of Hades. and Rudy's investors, who, as he made fairly plain when we first visited, said they didn't want to do Stagger Lee. Nobody ever heard of Stagger Lee. Let's do a disco movie. And let's do a Godfather movie.
Mm-hmm.
And Rudy was very disappointed. He made the picture and he put it across just like everything else he did. And yeah, the Ed Wood comparison is apt. I would say, however, that Rudy, unlike Ed Wood, did not have delusions of cinematic competence. He just went in there and bowled his way through.
Right.
And it worked.
Right. Right. Well, let's take a fresh look at Disco Godfather next time. And meanwhile, if you enjoy this podcast, we would love to have you support it by taking a look at the stuff that Michael and I have for sale on Amazon. I have the second installment of the Cleansing Trilogy, which set 1939 in the Arkansas Hills, is called Satan's Swine. And it's out now. We're getting some very good reviews on it. If you like old school weird tale style horror, as Michael said, and in the flap copy for our first book, I think you'll like this. And Michael, you've got the albums, and what else is going on?
Everything. Well, I'm working on the manuscript, or actually the book assembly for Forgotten Horrors Volume 13 right now.
Great. Great.
Taking it slow and easy. The book is already written, but you know, putting things together takes a little while.
It does indeed, if you're going to do it right.
Yeah. Indeed. Indeed it is.
And we will be back with you. Thank you so much for listening to the Forgotten Horrors podcast. I'm John Woolley. That's Michael H. Price. Joey Hambrick is our producer. Thank you, Joey. And we'll be back with you before you know it.
Love it.